White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. This is Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2013. I hope none of you went out and bought a teddy bear for a grown woman for today, but if any of you did, well, maybe you'll learn not to do that in the following years. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and...
I'm Hadding Scott.
Did you go and buy a teddy bear for...
No, I didn't do
our
that.
Our girlfriend. I always get kind of sick when I see that. It's one thing to give teddy bears to little kids, but, you know. Okay. I had to throw that in there.
You're performing a public service by warning men not to do that, I guess.
Yeah. I imagine some girls like it. I don't know. I'm sure they do. Maybe. Well, that's not a good subject to waste our time on. We have got some good stuff tonight. And so we're going to be returning to chapter 29 and complete chapter 29, no doubt, go on to chapter 30 tonight. I don't think we can complete both, but you never know. last week we read the first paragraphs of chapter 29, and the title of that is The Rise of the First Jewish Theatrical Trust. And I'm going to just do a little a review of what we read. And then Hadding will get going.
Actually, we did the first two paragraphs.
Yeah, that's what I said, didn't I?
No.
The first paragraphs. Ford's writers again express hope. Here it is. It started out about the pro-Semitism of Ben-Hur, which was a theatrical production at the time, not yet a film. And even though the pro-Semitism is not inherent in the story, it created a positive feeling about Jews in the country. But Ford's writers again express hope in these few paragraphs here, because they're really going to go into how bad this theatrical trust is. So they say that the reaction of the intelligent Jewish community against the attempts to utilize the stage as a hustings to boost the Jew into an unreal eminence and desirability means that there are Jews going against the grain. You know, he's saying that there are Jews out there who are going against the grain of the bad ones, even though, we see that this never comes to any positive result. But the international Jew, time and again, here and there, expresses the hope that these good Jews are going to do something worthwhile. And he says that, here's a quote, certain competent Jews wrote their opinions about this with much freedom and wisdom, and they evinced a spirit which, if it could be made to permeate all Jewish activities, would quickly dispose of the Jewish question. It is this spirit of judging Jewish interests in the light of the whole, which promises a helpful and lasting solution of all the differences which unfortunately have been permitted to arise between the people of Judah and the other. So, you know, they're always kind of encouraging. Every so often they try to encourage some kind of good movement from Jews, in looking at the good of the whole. Then they say, in order to be as fair as possible, the fact of Jewish control of the theater is not of itself a ground for complaint. If certain Jews working separately or in groups have succeeded in wrenching this rich business from its former Gentile control, that is purely a matter of commercial interest. In other words, we don't want to be whiners here. We don't want to be sitting here crying that, you know, you guys are taking all the business away from us. But they go on to say there is the ethical test of how the control was gained and how it is used, if for antisocial purposes. So we're going to see as we continue reading that it was indeed antisocial and simply more of what's good for the Jews.
Yeah, well, I don't really agree with the premise that it's an indifferent matter that mass media, which is what the theater was at that time, a mass media of entertainment. I don't think it's a matter of indifference if this is controlled by an alien population or even dominated by a particular segment of the population, because they're going to have particular interests that may not be the interests of everybody at large.
I think they're just saying that, like I said, to show that they're not whining. If people can do business in a fair way, even if they're Jewish, oh, that's all right. But the test is, how ethical are they? And they're always pointing out how they're not ethical. So I think that's just their attempt all the time. But it is what you say. They are saying, oh, it's okay if Jews are here, and even if they have powerful business interests, if they are fair-minded. Well, yeah, that's setting up an impossible expectation. So I agree with you, Henning.
All right. So the fact that the old-time Gentile-producing managers usually died poor, Augustine Daly being about the only exception, while Jewish-producing managers wax immensely wealthy, there being on this side the exception of the late Charles Frohman, would indicate that the Gentile managers were better artists and poorer businessmen than the Jewish managers. At least poorer businessmen, perhaps. And in any case, working on a system whose chief object was to produce plays and not profits. The starving artists. The advent of Jewish control put the theater on a more commercialized basis than it had previously known. It really represented applying the trust idea to the theater before it had been largely applied to industry. As early as the year 1896, the Theatrical Trust controlled 37 theaters in strategic cities. The men controlling this alliance were Claw and Erlanger, Nixon and Zimmerman, and Heyman and Frohman. All but Zimmerman were Jews, and his racial origin was a subject of dispute. This group was later joined by Rich and Harris of Boston and Joseph Brooks, all known as Jews. Controlling these theaters, the trust was able to assure a long season to both managers and playing companies. Outside the trust, the managers and companies were left to make arrangements between each other, which resembled a species of barnstorming. The effect on the independent theaters and managers was disastrous. The trust boosted royalties on plays from $50 to $450 and eventually to $1,000 a week. This of itself cut off the material of the stock companies with which the independent managers endeavored to keep open their houses. The running out of the stock companies by excessive charges for the use of plays that had already been used in the regular theaters of the trust really served Jewish interests in another way. The motion picture industry was coming to the front. It was a Jewish enterprise from the first. There never was any need to drive Gentiles out of that, because the Gentiles had never had a chance to get in. Thus, the driving out of the stock companies threw the empty theaters over to the movies, and the benefit was again confined to a particular racial group. And I actually would like, well, I have some contrary information about this claim that the Gentiles had never gotten into the film industry. I have a few sentences here. This is from Jack Wyckoff's review of Neil Gabler's An Empire of Their Own. Gabler is a Jew, and he wrote about how Jews created Hollywood. Later, that was turned into a documentary made-for-TV movie called Hollywoodism. But this is what Jack Wyckoff says in his review of Gabler's book. It can safely be said that the earliest cameras, projectors, sound and lighting equipment and raw film stock were developed primarily by Gentile inventors. The same can be said of those artists who were the first to create artistic movies with true narrative content, creative lighting, and special effects. Panoramic scenic settings and fast-paced editing. Creative non-Jewish individuals such as W.K.L. Dixon, William Frieza Green, Thomas Armat, Georges Méliès, Louis and Auguste Lumière, and Charles Pathé are not even mentioned by Gabler. Edwin S. Porter, the director of the early narrative film and first Western, The Great Train Robbery, 1903, was also an engineer who developed cameras, projectors, and special effects devices. In Neil Gabler's An Empire of Their Own, Porter is dismissed as a projectionist turned director. Thomas Edison is portrayed as a villain for his great power in the early film industry. Edison and his partners created the Motion Picture Patents Company in 1908, which until 1918 held an almost complete monopoly in camera and projection equipment licensing. What these Jewish producers did achieve was to move very quickly from owning a few Nickelodeons to controlling complete monopolies consisting of production, distribution, and exhibition facilities. These men acquired this control because of an excellent sense of what the public would buy, intense personal drive, group solidarity as Jews, a willingness for hard work, and a lot of shady dealing. Gabler describes how Adolf Zukor and Karl Lemle, these are Jews, illegally used Edison cameras without paying the royalties, and how Louis B. Mayer cheated the producers of Birth of a Nation by falsifying his bookkeeping, he says, out of $500,000 in 1915. He says they moved to, these Jews moved their film industry to Hollywood from the East Coast in the teens and 20s because of, in part, the enforcers of Edison's patents company, because they really couldn't make a film without violating Edison's patents. And Edison had these teams of men that he would send out to smash up their equipment.
If they were violating his patents.
That's right, which they really couldn't avoid doing if they were making movies. That's my understanding.
You know, it may be that the International Jew is going to deal with the movies at a later date. I don't know, because it's kind of odd that where we stand right now, because Edison it was a good friend of Henry Ford, and he would be certainly very aware of all of this, but none of this is mentioned.
Yeah.
In this, but it may come up at a later time. You know, obviously I'm just reading the book as we go along here. I decided to do that rather than try to sit down and read the whole thing. So
yeah, and by the way, it's an interesting thing. I found this out on Wikipedia. The first feature-length movies were made in Australia. They had the Australian film industry. It really got the jump on the American film industry. They had a number of feature films made, and the names of the people who made the films don't seem to be Jewish. Before D.W. Griffith made First Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, well, I think that obviously there were creative white people carrying on, looking into all this, researching and trying things out and so on. And then the Jews just took hold of the business end of it and got control of it all. We'll see. What we're going to be learning about the theater industry is just exactly the way they operate, and they would have done it the same way with motion pictures. So even though people aren't too much too knowledgeable about the theater at this time, live theater, you can just think about it in terms of film, the film industry too. And you know, the stock company, some people might not be aware what that means. If you ever heard of summer stock, well, there used to be a lot of that. And they talk about these are when the plays would be either tried out outside of the major metropolises, and particularly New York, and then go to New York for their big openings, or the other times of the year they do these, after they had been run in, say, New York and Boston and other big cities, then they would go and maybe with not so famous stars in them, and perform in these other smaller theater groups in smaller cities and towns and stuff around the country. And that was what was called the stock, right? That's what the word they use for that. Well, I do believe so. okay. That was, we can go on, I guess.
All right. Yeah. By the early 1920s, the Jews had beaten Edison, which is when this was written.
Yeah.
This will answer the question so frequently asked by people who wonder why the theaters they formerly saw offering plays at all seasons are now devoting the larger part of the year to movies. It was not to be expected that this sort of thing could be put through without a struggle. There was a struggle, and a severe one, but it has ended with what the public can see today. The opposition offered by the artists of the stage was prolonged and dignified. Francis Wilson, Nat C. Goodwin, James A. Hearn, James O'Neill, Richard Mansfield, Mrs. Fisk, and James K. Hackett stood out for a time, all of them, with the exception of Goodwin, bound by a forfeit of $1,000 if they deserted to the cause of a free theater.
If they deserted
the cause
yeah.
of a free theater. Joseph Jefferson was always with the actors in this opposition and continued of the same mind to the end, playing in both trust and antitrust houses. It is a matter of record that Nat Goodwin was the first to give in. He was the head and front of the opposition, but he had his weaknesses, which were well known to the trust, and upon these they played. One of his weaknesses was for New York engagements, and he was offered a long engagement at the Knickerbocker Theater. He was also given the promise of dates wherever and whenever he wanted them. Goodwin thereupon deserted the alliance of stars and became the henchman of the Trust. The Trust was the name by which the new control was known in these days. The racial name was not given, although the racial nature was plainly discerned.
You mean the Jewish Trust. Everybody knew it was the Jewish Trust, but they weren't, just like always, we're so timid, so unwilling to speak out. They wouldn't call it the Jewish, they just call it the Trust, and everybody was supposed to know what was meant.
Nat Goodwin's star began to decline from that day. He made a final essay as Shylock, and with that he was practically ushered out as a headliner of the serious stage.
So he went along with the Jews, and they were giving him everything he wanted, and then they kicked him out.
Yeah, they used and discarded him.
Yeah, really, just like, that's it.
Richard Mansfield and Francis Wilson were delivering nightly curtain speeches against the Trust wherever they appeared. And although the public was sympathetic, it was very much like the present state of affairs. What could the public do? What can an unorganized public ever do against a small, organized, determined minority? That's the eternal question.
Well, I think this is important, too, in that this is what we need to understand, that when we say, well, we get enough people woken up and do that, no, that's never going to happen, because an unorganized public, even if it's aware of what's going on, they say here the public was sympathetic, they didn't like, they understood what was going on, but they still went to the theater, whoever put them on, they're not going to do anything. It's going to be a small, organized, determined minority. And that's what we need to have.
Yeah.
Doing something. Okay.
Yeah. The public hardly ever appears as a party in any of the movements that concern itself. The public is the prize for which the parties strive. The Trust dealt strongly with Wilson. His dates were canceled. neither his status nor his ability was of any avail to him. One of the trust made an open statement, quote, Mr. Wilson is a shining mark, and we determined to make an example of him for the benefit of the lesser offenders.
Can you imagine? I thought that was just amazing. They come right out and talk like that.
Yeah.
We're going to make an example of him because he's going up against us, giving us a hard time.
Rebellious goy. Wilson's strong spirit was finally subdued to see reason. In 1898, the Philadelphia members of the trust offered him $50,000 for his business, and he took it. In due time, Richard Mansfield also surrendered, and Mrs. Fisk was left alone to carry on the fight. The theatrical trust, which must be described as Jewish, because it was that, was at the beginning of the new century in full control of the field. It had reduced what was essentially an art to a time clock cash register system, working with the mechanical precision of a well-managed factory.
Yeah, so here they say, I'm sorry to interrupt, Hattie, here they say at the beginning of the new century. So there was this story I was telling you about. It was in 1901 where Mrs. Fisk was she, right in the middle of all this, and she was giving a she gave a long speech at some theatrical group that was supportive, and it was printed up in the New York Times. I'm not going to refer to that or read it, but that was said that it was 1901. So this would be when this was going on at around 1901.
The trust suppressed individuality and initiative, killed off competition, drove out the independent manager and star, excluded all but foreign playwrights of established reputation, fostered the popularity of inferior talent, inferior Jewish talent, which was predominantly Jewish, sought to debase the service of the dramatic critics of the public press, foisted countless stars of mushroom growth upon a helpless public, while driving real stars into obscurity. It handled plays, theaters, and actors like factory products, and now began a process of vulgarizing and commercializing everything connected with the theater. If space permitted, a number of opinions could be presented here from men like William Dean Howells, Norman Hapgood, and Thomas Bailey Aldrich, whose concern was for the theater, but who voiced no other observations as to the racial influences at work. Their concern was justified. It is quite possible that many who read this article are not interested in the theater and are in fact convinced that the theater is a menace. Very well, what principally makes it a menace? This, that the stage today represents the principal cultural element of 50% of the people. What the average young person absorbs as to good form, proper deportment, refinement, as contrasted with coarseness, correctness of speech, or choice of words. This is a little bit hard to read. What the average young person absorbs as to good form, proper deportment, refinement, as contrasted with coarseness, correctness of speech or choice of words, customs and feelings of other nations, even fashions of clothes, as well as ideas of religion and law, are derived from what he sees and hears at the theater. So this is what television is doing now.
Yeah, I was going to say like the movies today, but even television is more like it. All right.
The mass's sole idea of the homes and the life of the rich is derived from the stage and the movies. More wrong notions are given. More prejudices created by the Jewish-controlled theater in 1 week than can be charged against a serious study of the Jewish question in a century. People sometimes wonder where the ideas of the younger generation come from. This is the answer. as was just said, all the original opposers of this new control of the theater surrendered and left Mrs. Fisk to fight alone. She had, however, an ally in her husband, Harrison Gray Fisk, who was editor of the New York Dramatic Mirror. Mrs. Fisk herself had said, do you want to do that?
All right. The incompetent, yes, the incompetent men who have seized upon the affairs of the stage in this country have all but killed art, ambition, and decency.
Yes. I could have done a voice, but it would have, well, anyway.
But do her husband.
Her husband wrote in his paper, what then should be expected of a band of adventurers of infamous origin, of no breeding, and utterly without artistic taste? Let it be kept in mind that the ruling number of these men who compose the theatrical trust are absolutely unfit to serve in any but the most subordinate places in the economy of the stage, and that they ought not to be tolerated even in these places except under a discipline active, vigorous, and uncompromising. Their records are disreputable and in some cases criminal, and their methods are in keeping with their records. First printed in the Dramatic Mirror, December 25th, 1897, reprinted March 19th, 1898. This attack was regarded, foolishly and wrongfully, of course, as an attack upon the whole House of Israel, and as is always the case when one Jew is censured for wrongdoing, all the Jews in the United States came to the rescue. Pressure was brought to bear on a famous news company which handled the circulation of the most important magazines in the United States. Leading hotels were induced to withdraw the Dramatic Mirror from their newsstands. Mirror correspondents were refused admittance to theaters controlled by the trust. Any number of underground influences were set in operation to get Fisk and his business. Suit was brought against Fisk for $10,000 in damages for the strictures he had printed upon the personal character of certain members of the trust. Fisk replied in his answer, setting up various facts against specific members of the trust, their records, actions, and so on. One he accused of carrying on business under a fictitious name, or cover name, as it is known in Jewish circles. Another he accused of charging managers for advertising expenses that were never incurred. Another he accused of issuing complimentary tickets in which he did a private speculative business of his own, selling them and pocketing the proceeds. Another he accused of specific crime for which he had been arrested and convicted. He charged that the trust as a whole advertised in various cities and that the original New York company would play, charging exorbitant admission fees on the strength of this advertisement, and when in truth these were secondary companies and not the one advertised. A strange court hearing was held in which the magistrate did not wish to hear any of Fisk's testimony, even forbidding him to enter official records of the criminal proceedings had against a certain member of the trust. Okay, that doesn't make sense the way that's written, but I read it the way it was written. The magistrate did not seem to want to hear what Fisk based his statements upon. There was a serious shooting scrape involving a woman, but the magistrate did not want to hear about it. There was even considerable difficulty on the part of Fisk's lawyer in procuring the attendance of Abraham L. Erlanger at court, although he was one of the complainants. All the important questions asked of Claw were overruled. As to Al Heyman, the court overruled all questions relating to his real name and the circumstances under which he left Australia. The facts were not brought out in this hearing, but the whole character of the hearing was made known to the public. Fisk was bound over to the grand jury with $300 bail in every allegation of libel.
This is like this is nothing new like what they do in the Holocaust denial trials. I mean, they've been doing this in trials just outright, I don't know, what you call outright dishonesty and criminality right there in the court. I mean, the judge is bought off and he's setting the whole thing up.
All right. The grand jury lost no time in dismissing all the complaints against Fisk. The trust members had come off badly because of their evident unwillingness to meet the case. They were revealed to be a much lower type of men than the American public had supposed was in charge of the American theater. They were shown to be a type that would not even stop at demanding the discharge of a local newspaper reporter whose critique of their plays did not please them. The fight of the dramatic critics, first against the bribery and then against the bludgeoning of the theatrical trust, makes a story of which echoes have frequently come to the American public through the press. Conciliatory at first, with managers, actors, playwrights, and critics, the trust, as soon as it gained power, showed the claws beneath the velvet. It had the millions of dollars of the public coming its way. Why should it care? Whenever a critic opposed its methods or pointed out the inferior, coarse, and degrading character of the trust productions, he was ordered barred from the trust's theaters, and local managers were instructed to demand his discharge from his newspaper. It is with mingled feelings that an American is compelled to relate that in many, many cases the demand was complied with, the papers being threatened with the loss of Sunday advertising. But here and there, courageous writers on the stage held to the honor of their profession and refused to be bribed or intimidated. Writers like James S. Metcalf of Life, Hilary Bell of the New York Press, Frederick F. Schrader of the Washington Post, Norman Hapgood on the New York Evening Globe, James O'Donnell Bennett of the Chicago Record Herald, stood out against the trust and made their fight. Metcalf went so far as to bring suit against the trust for unlawful exclusion from a place of public entertainment. The courts were kind to the trust. They decided that a theater may pick its patrons. Even in very recent years, the trust has followed blacklisted dramatic critics in an effort to prevent their employment by newspapers.
Bad.
That principle didn't seem to hold up during the civil rights movement, that a private establishment could pick its patrons.
Right.
The theatrical trust does not exist in the form it did 10 years ago. It grew arrogant and bred secret enemies among its own people. A new force arose. But it also was Jewish, as it originated in the Schubert brothers with David Belasco. Instead of one, the American people have now a dual dictatorship of the stage. The rage of the day is not plays, but playhouses. With not three plays of any character to distinguish them from the dregs of the stage, there are now building in New York alone a dozen new playhouses. The theatrical business has entered upon its real estate phase. There is money in renting chairs at the rate of $1 to $3 an hour. The renting of the chairs is a reality. The stage is rapidly becoming an illusion.
All right, that's the end of that chapter, which was in the January 8th issue, 1921, of the Dearborn Independent. And so this shows the kind of really, and the next chapter is going to go into it. And I've got this New York Times newspaper article from February from 1907. What am I talking about? I forget what date it is. It's down at the bottom. Let's see. February 1st, 1907. And this gives a little more idea. I think it's worthwhile reading. I told you before we started, to show just how these people behaved. The headline is Indicts Theater Trust for Restraint of Trade. And grand jury returns a blanket bill against six members, all but two out of town. You know, they do these whole bunches of headlines on these old, in the old newspaper articles. Samuel Nixon, J.F. Zimmerman, Mark Claw, Abraham Erlanger, Charles Frohman, and Al Haymon named. These are all the people mentioned in this chapter that you read. And this was in 1907, a little bit later from what they were things they were talking about. And it says, a blanket bill of indictment charging six members of the so-called Theatrical Trust with conspiracy in restraint of trade was returned yesterday by the grand jury. The theatrical managers named in the indictment are Samuel Nixon and J.F. Zimmerman, composing the firm of Nixon and Zimmerman of Philadelphia and New York, Mark Claw and Abraham Erlanger of the firm of Claw and Erlanger, and Charles Frohman and Al Haymon, all of this city. Of these men, only Claw and Erlanger are now in town. Nixon and Zimmerman are, they're saying where the other men are. Some of them are in Europe. Some of them are in Philadelphia, but they're returning. All right, the indictment, filling 70 typewritten pages, was handed up to Judge Foster in Part 1 of General Sessions at 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. Messrs. Claw and Erlanger had already been summoned by their counsel, Alfred Lautenbach, and were awaiting Judge Foster in his private chambers on his return from luncheon. Without the formality of having the men appear in court, the proceedings of admitting the indicted managers to bail were carried out in Judge Foster's chamber. Bail in the amount of $1,000 each was furnished by Big Tim Sullivan, who gave as security the Dewey Theater in East 14th Street, which he said was worth $300,000. Soon afterward, Judge Foster called the case of the people against Claw and Erlanger. In Part 1 of General Sessions, neither Mr. Claw nor Mr. Erlanger appeared in the courtroom, where they were represented by Mr. Lauterbach. Now, at the request of Assistant District Attorney Kressel, pleading to the indictments was put over until a week from Monday. Mr. Kressel, I don't know how important that is. Okay, later in the day, this is good, following a statement was issued at the offices of Al Haymon and Claw and Erlanger. So they put out this statement. We are not surprised at this indictment, as it has been street and table talk for over a year. The malice and motives which inspired it are tales of another telling and will be a subject of wonderment to the uninitiated. They're gonna present it as total fabrication, see? If anyone doubts the demoralization of the present district attorney's office, he need only notice the freedom with which grand jury proceedings are published daily. Certainly the witnesses and grand jurors themselves would not talk about what happens in the grand jury room. Every business institution which develops to large proportions is in danger of being denominated a trust. And an indictment for being a member of a trust seems to be the badge of success pinned on successful businessmen by their unsuccessful competitors. It will not be long in this fair land before every successful businessman will be indicted for being a member of a trust. The stigma which used to go with an indictment has been entirely eliminated by proceedings such as these. So, you know how they're so clever, you know, and their lawyers figured that would tell them what to say, but being indicted for something like this doesn't mean anything. You know, it's just totally ridiculous and pointless.
They're just jealous because Jews are more successful.
Yeah. And the other guys had nothing to say. It says the indictment sets forth in detail the acts of the so-called trust. The charge is that the managers have conspired to monopolize the theatrical business, both as to ownership of theaters and as to the production of theatrical attractions. Under the statute, such a violation of the interstate law is a misdemeanor. That's all it is, a misdemeanor. The conspiracy, it is charged, takes the form of written agreements entered into in 1896 and 1900 by the indicted managers. By these agreements, the several managers agreed to pool theaters and attractions and divide the profits of the business. At the time of the organization of the so-called trust, the indictment points out, it controlled 50 theaters throughout the country. At the present time, it absolutely controls 500 of the 600 prominent ones. The indictment also shows that the managers agreed to permit their own attractions to appear in none but theaters controlled by themselves and to refuse to permit other attractions to appear in houses under their control unless under the contracts it was arranged that they should appear in such houses exclusively. I don't know. They further agreed not to send their own attractions to any theater whose manager refused to contract with them to control the bookings of his theater. It is upon the contracts exacted from managers of productions appearing in houses controlled by the combination that the district attorney's office bases its strongest hopes of obtaining conviction. The indictment also charges that by means of the combination, the managers have coerced actors, playwrights, and owners and have compelled owners of many theaters to give the syndicate exclusive control of the bookings of their theaters, in payment for which the syndicate has extorted from 25 to 50% of the profits of the houses. With the power thus obtained, the indictment points out the syndicate has been enabled to crush obstinate owners by refusing to send them attractions and by compelling them to keep their houses dark, in the same way they held the whip hand over owners of attractions. As an instance of the methods of the syndicate, the case of Sarah Bernhardt is cited. She was a French, very, very, very famous French actress of the theater. In her last tour of this country in 1905, permission was refused her to play in syndicate houses for the reason that she was appearing under the direction of a rival firm of managers. In her tour, Mademoiselle Bernhardt played only independent houses and was frequently forced to appear under tents. Mademoiselle Bernhardt was angered at the time by the inconvenience she was compelled to suffer and declared that she would gladly come to this country and assist in prosecuting the men who had created the situation in which she found herself. And the district attorney said that he promised that he would call her here if it was necessary. It is improbable, however, that she would be called upon to return. Then they say the experience of May Irwin when she was appearing in Mrs. Black is Back was cited before the grand jury as further illustrating the methods of the syndicate. She was unable to obtain booking in an independent house in Providence, Rhode Island, and booking was offered to her only if she should continue over the trust circuit. Now they bring up David Belasco. The finding of the indictment yesterday is the result of the fight which was instituted against the trust some time ago by David Belasco. More than 30 witnesses have appeared before the grand jury in the last 2 weeks in which evidence has been heard. And among them, among those who were giving testimony was David Belasco, Lee Schubert. He's not a good guy either. H.R. Jacobs, William F. Connor of Liebler and Company, and A.C. Campbell of the Bijou Theater. Now, this last paragraph is good. It says, in the testimony taken, some of the witnesses have said that they had been compelled to make contracts with the syndicate for booking at a cost of nearly 33 1/3%. Talk about usury, see?
Wow.
Of the 33 1/3% of the net receipts of the production. Net receipts of the production. It was also testified that the trust productions thus appearing at the houses frequently got from 50 to 60% of the profits, leaving the house to pocket the meager balance. So anyway. That was going on, you know. It was written about in the New York Times. Now, I think that they lost this. I don't think that I think these guys got away in this particular legal proceeding.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, but seems like I read something like that somewhere, but it must have been here in the International Jew, so we'll have to see. So let's see. We've got 15 minutes yet, so we can go ahead and start Chapter 30, huh?
All right. How Jews capitalized a protest against Jews. The American stage is under the influence and control of a group of former bootblacks, newsboys, ticket speculators, prize ring habitués, and Bowery characters. At the present writing, the most advertised man in the world of theatrical production is Morris Guest, a Russian Jew who has produced the most salacious spectacles ever shown in America, Aphrodite and Mecca. It is reported that the scent of nastiness has been so strongly circulated among theatergoers that tickets are sold a year ahead for the Chicago exhibition of one of these shows, the patrons being, of course, mostly Gentiles. Now, it is a fair question. Who is this Morris Guest who stalks before his fellow Jews as the most successful producer of the year? It is nothing against him to say that he comes from Russia. It is nothing against him to say that he is a Jew. It is nothing against him to say that although success has favored him, his father and mother are still in Odessa, or were until recently. Yet, in a recent interview in which the professional note of pathos was obtrusively present, he lamented that he was not able to bring his parents to America. His name, by the way, is Gershonovitz.
He spells it G-E-S-T.
Yeah. Real name Gershonovitz, or that's his birth name anyway. And he was born in Lithuania.
Well, I said his parents are still in Odessa.
Yeah, but he was born in Lithuania.
Okay. All right.
The story of Morris Guest is the last one in the world to use as a success story of the type of the poor immigrant boy who became a great theatrical producer. He is not a great producer, of course, although he is a great panderer to the least creditable tastes of a public whose taste he has been no mean factor in debasing. Guest sold newspapers in Boston and became property boy in a Boston theater. In 1906, he was a member of a notorious gang of ticket speculators who were the bane of the public until ticket peddling on the sidewalks in front of theaters was suppressed by the police. There are still other stories told about him that link his name with another sort of traffic, but whether these stories are true or not, there is nothing in Guest's career to indicate that he would ever contribute anything to the theater's best interest. He is the son-in-law of David Belasco.
And David Belasco is a Sephardic Jew.
He's a Sephardic Jew, yeah. Then there is Sam Harris, long the junior partner of the firm of Cohan and Harris, who began his career in the arts by managing Dixon, the colored champion featherweight pugilist, and the redoubtable Terry McGovern, champion lightweight prize fighter. With tastes formed at the ringside, he launched into theatrical ventures, allying himself with Al Woods. He catered to the lower classes and made a fortune by producing atrocious melodramas in second and third class houses. And yet, this is the Sam Harris who commands the patronage of hundreds of thousands, yes, millions of theatergoers, some of whom go on innocently believing that when they invade the theater, they also enter, by some mystical process, the realms of art.
I really love that sense. I thought that was really good. And I looked up this Sam Harris, but I couldn't find any sign that he was Jewish.
He told us that he was, though.
Oh, who told us he was?
It's already been stated.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, they don't want to talk about it, but Harris is often Jewish.
No demonstration was given, but it has been stated. And this person named Nixon that they said was Jewish, Nixon is really an Irish name, but some Jews did take Irish names when they arrived. So
I'll take the word. I didn't know it was Irish name. Nixon was Irish?
The name Nixon, Irish? I believe, is Irish.
Uh-huh. I wouldn't know what that was. Okay.
Yeah. Al H. Woods has but one good eye. It is not this personal loss that matters, but the history of the misfortune, which goes back to the time when Al was a member of an East Side gang. The common report was that he used to play the piano in a downtown place, east of Fifth Avenue. Mr. Woods is also a distinguished patron of dramatic art. He presented The Girl from Rector's and The Girl in the Taxi, two of the most immoral and pointless shows of recent years. Several times he has secured the rights to certain Viennese operas, which were bad enough in themselves from a moral point of view, but which were at least constructed with true artistry. But even these he marred by an inept fusion of vulgarity and blague. The public, of course, does not see and does not know these gods before whom they pour their millions yearly, nor does the public know from what source theatric vileness comes. It is amusing to listen to the fledgling philosophers discuss the tendencies of the stage, or expatiate learnedly on the divine right of art, to be as flippant and filthy as it pleases, when all the time the tendency is started and the art is determined by men whose antecedents would make art scream. The American theater is a small group of Jewish promoters and a large group of Gentile gullibles. And it is only the latter who kid themselves that there is anything real about the matter. It is perfectly natural, therefore, that the complete Judaization of the theater should result in its being transformed into the show business, a mere matter of trade and barter. The real producers are often not culturally equipped for anything more than the baldest business. They can hire what they want: mechanicians, costumers, painters, writers, musicians. With their gauge of public taste and their models of action formed upon the racetrack and the prize ring, with their whole ideal modeled upon the ambition to pander to depravity instead of serving legitimate needs, it is not surprising that the standards of the theater should now be at their lowest mark. As theatergoers are noticing, more and more, the Jewish manager, whenever possible, employs Jewish actors and actresses. Gentile playwrights and actors are steadily diminishing in number for want of a market. At times, the employment of Jewish actors has been so obtrusive as to endanger the success of the play. This was notably the case when the part of a young Christian girl of the early Christian era was given to a Jewess of pronounced racial features. The selection was so glaringly inept, ethnically and historically, that it militated strongly against the impression the play was intended to produce.
Well, that's just so typical. You know, they love to put the wrong people in a part. And, of course, here they're putting a Jew playing a young Christian girl of the early Christian era. But they also do, sometimes now they put Negro actors in parts that are well-known historical figures that were white. It's just amazing.
It has a different motive, though.
Yeah, well, who knows what their motive here. The motive here is probably just to give a job to the Jewish actors.
Yeah. Pushing their fellow Jews. I told you in that interview that Larry King used to push his Jewish buddies all the time, and it was very obvious that that's what he was doing.
Like what? On his program, push
buddies? Matthew Lesko and other people that he knew from the old neighborhood in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah, well, of course, they do that. They all do that.
Yep.
That's right.
Well, Larry King was very obvious about it. This really conjures a comic vision, this description of the Jewess of pronounced racial features trying to play a young Christian girl. You could make that humorous.
Yeah, I thought it was.
Yeah. The cover name conceals from the theater-going public the fact that the actors and actresses who purvey entertainment are, in large and growing proportion, Jewish. Some of the more prominent Jewish actors, many of them prime favorites, are Al Jolson, Charlie Chaplin, Louis Mann, Sam Bernard, David Warfield, Joe Weber, Barney Bernard, Ed Wynn, or to mention his real name, Israel Leopold, Lou Fields, Eddie Cantor, Robert Warwick. Charlie Chaplin, by the way, was not a Jew.
Oh, wasn't he?
Well, according to Wilmot Robertson, Charlie Chaplin allowed other people to believe that he was a Jew to help his career, and he was Irish, French, and 1/8 Gypsy, according to Wilmot Robertson.
Hmm. Well, you think Wilmot Robertson is the ultimate source on that?
Well, he was doing research after Ford, so he probably was, you know, checking things more than Ford did or whoever wrote this.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Okay, there's some more.
The later work on any subject is likely to be a little more thorough than the original work.
That's right.
So I accept Wilmot Robertson's correction there. Among the prominent Jewish actresses are Theda Bara, Nora Bays, Olga Nethersole, Irene Franklin, Gertrude Hoffman, Mizi Hajos, Fanny Bryce, who is the wife of Nikki Arnstein, Bertha Kalish, Josie Collins, Ethel Levy, Belle Baker, Constance Collier. The late Anna Held was a Jewess. Some of those names are obviously Jewish. In addition to these are others whose racial identity is not revealed by their names or any public knowledge about them.
Well, let's stop there. We've got less than 60 seconds. You know this Fanny Bryce. She's the one who played that on the radio, that little schnooky, wasn't it?
Uh-huh.
That little bratty girl. And everybody liked her. So everybody loved that, you know, all the white people. My Little Schnooks or something. You don't remember that.
It's vaguely familiar.
Yeah. Well, it was well known in my family. In fact, they used to call my older
Baby
sister
Snooks.
That. Baby Snooks, that was it. Baby Snooks, yeah. And she had this funny little voice, and she was made to have these real funny lines and everything. So, you know, they get some good material for these Jewish people, and then all the white, you know, all the non-Jews just eat it up and forget that they don't even know that they're Jews, probably.
Yeah. Anyway. And Bryce, of course, is an Irish surname that she assumes.
Yeah. Okay, folks, we will continue with this next week and then go on to the next chapter and probably finish it. So come back to us.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.